It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades of research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is Dialogue Conspiracy 210, August the 18th, 1974. We have to change the intro into this program. That was made a year ago. We're into our fifth year now. I've been doing programs here for 4 years, not three, and we'll have to change that soon because since this spring it's been 5 years. We're starting the fifth year at KLRB. The San Jose Mercury had a front page story today which excited me and which my regular listeners will be interested in, and the people who've read my articles. I'm very excited about different events that took place in the news this week in terms of my research and what is happening. The front page story of the San Jose Mercury Associated Press story dated August 18, 1975. Stockholders action, Hughes is dead, suit filed in New York. Two Manhattan stockholders have filed a lawsuit against the Hughes Corporation, against Air West. I'll read you the article, Associated Press story, containing that Howard Hughes is dead. For those of you that have listened to my shows for the last months, particularly in the last months, I've accelerated the information on the Hughes data bank in Utah, the Hughes connections to Intertel. The bulk of the show today is going to be on Interpol, as against Intertel. Intertel is the organization that was formed in 1970 by government and intelligence officials that contain the Hughes empire. Hughes no longer exists. Interpol or international police, and we'll go into the links of these two organizations to Watergate. But the Hughes story is very big. With Stephanie Caruana, I published an article in Playgirl, December 74, on the burial of Howard Hughes. I've alleged that Onassis buried him April 18th, 1971, off an island in Greece. And I've been waiting for the Hughes story to break. Hughes has not been seen in many, many years. There's a power struggle there, and I was very excited to read this. I'll read a little bit of this article for those of you that may not have seen the article in today's paper. It said, the two Manhattan stockholders have filed suit contending that Hughes is dead. If the elusive billionaire doesn't respond to their satisfaction, they intend to ask the court to appoint an administrator for his estate. The civil complaint in state Supreme Court alleges that while Hughes is reputed to be resigning at Hotel Xanadu at the Grand Bahamas, he has been dead for a considerable period, last past, that's a legal term, and is claimed to be alive, this is a quotation, for the personal profit of various and sundry people, persons, end quote. The term last past is a legal reference meaning an indefinite period of time. The suit was brought by Victor and Ellen Kurtz, minority stockholders of Air Liquidation Company, formerly known as Air West Incorporated. A class damage suit of $100 million against Air West was taken over, they claim it was taken over by Hughes in 1969, and the suit contends that Hughes and some of his associates deliberately depressed the price of the stock to make the sale of the airline to Hughes more attractive to stockholders, and that the airline directors who opposed the sale were pressured by the filing of lawsuits. The American Stock Exchange is named as a defendant on the grounds it didn't take the proper steps to disclose allegedly fraudulent manipulation of stock prices. Listed as defendants in this suit are Sumo Corporation, formerly the Hughes Tool Company, Chester C. Davis, chief legal counsel for Sumo Corporation, and Hanson Sales, a New York accounting firm. The Kurtzes have an attorney, I. Walton Bader, B-A-D-E-R, in New York City, and he contends the conspiracy at the heart of the litigations involves Hughes, and without Hughes, how can you prove a conspiracy? Bader said if Hughes fails to respond to the New York action, he would press for the appointment of an administrator of the Hughes estate to handle disposition of all the billionaire's assets. The man, as far as we know, has no children. We don't know if there's a will. Nobody has seen him for 10 years or more. Unless it can be proved otherwise, he is either dead or incompetent, and the burden of proof is on Mr. Hughes or those acting in his behalf. The suit contends that Hughes was absent from New York State since at least 68, has not made a personal appearance for many years. Bader said no immigration official saw Hughes despite reports he was in 9 localities in 5 countries, ranging from Las Vegas to London to Vancouver, Managua, Nicaragua in the past 9 years. I called the Kurtz family today in New York City, offered them my research on the fact that Howard Hughes was in fact dead, and told them that I just did several radio shows in New York. My weekly show here is played back there on Friday nights, and I did another AM station in New York City, and I've been hitting very hard at the Hughes question. The Hughes mystery is the most important fact as far as a researcher, as far as I'm concerned. It takes precedence over the John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King assassination investigation, because when you break down the Hughes empire, all roads lead to the Hughes empire. All these conspiracies, mind control, future genocide, data banks, and the elimination of certain races, the racism, the murdering of prime witnesses, the manipulation of a lot that is going on that barely was touched at Watergate. Last week I said the tip of the iceberg was the Hughes story. That's what Baker, Howard Baker, hasn't revealed. That's what the Senate committee didn't go into, the Rebozo Hughes, the Senator Smathers, the Richard Nixon story, and then the takeover of Hughes after 71, the empire, the selling of the tool company, and the monopoly of particular persons in order to maintain a power trip. Now, their allegation is that people have taken Mr. Howard Hughes, who's been dead for a long time, for profit of various and sundry persons. My research, Dialogue Conspiracy, goes into the assassination of people, the murder of people. There's more than money profit. There's a power game here, a very dirty, heavy power game. And until we find out who is manipulating and how they're manipulating, we can't solve these individual conspiracies. So those of you who listen to this show regularly or read my article know how excited I was to see the news of this lawsuit. The lawyer handling this lawsuit will be out in Carmel in a few weeks. I will give him information. He will give information to me. Hopefully he'll be on the radio show. He said he would be. And we'll talk about this, and we'll talk about Howard Hughes some more, and you'll be hearing me talk about it for many, many weeks to come. I also felt a satisfaction this week of victory when the Board of Supervisors in Los Angeles voted unanimously to open up the investigation of Senator Robert Kennedy. I was the first personal investigator, private investigator, to offer to go to the Los Angeles Police Department to say there was a conspiracy to kill Robert Kennedy. I spoke to a Sergeant Pageant and a Sergeant Collins of the police force 3 weeks after Robert Kennedy was assassinated. It was just the beginning of July, 1968, and I wanted to come to them with evidence that there was a conspiracy to kill Robert Kennedy. And I was told that there'd be 23 task force investigating this, that the district attorney at the time, Evel Younger, who's now our attorney general, didn't want another Jim Garrison coming along, another John Kennedy scandal, and he was going to have a thorough investigation. But right from the beginning, they wouldn't let me, as a researcher who had done 4 years' work into the other assassination, go to Los Angeles. So now it's 7 years later, and I was the first researcher that I know of to say that there was a conspiracy. They wouldn't let me go, and it's 7 years later, and the matter is going to be opened up unanimously. They voted, and that, again, was a first for me, and I'm very happy. Through a lot of work, combined efforts of a handful of people, the matter has been kept open for 7 years, and it's going to be investigated in Los Angeles. Another victory as a news person and a personal victory on my part, one of the most satisfying things of all my research, because I like looking into these matters. I like to see the truth come out. I feel that we are one step farther away from fascism as we expose these devils. But it intermingled with my work at a general level, there are particular people that I've taken a tremendous amount of interest in the last few years. One of them is Hugo Pinnell, a defendant in the San Quentin 6 trial, and the other is Robert Hyde. Robert Hyde is a prisoner, was a prisoner, who was paroled 2 weeks ago. I have to tell you the punchline, those of you who have heard me talk about Robert Hyde, he was paroled 2 weeks ago. I spoke with him on the telephone, and he will be coming down to do a show with me when he can get down here. He's with his family, his wife and children in Modesto, and he was released from the California prison system. Robert was knowledgeable all the time about the assassination of John Kennedy. He says that's why he was imprisoned 7 years ago on a framed charge. He had information about the conspiracy to kill Robert Kennedy. He placed a lawsuit against the California prison authorities, against Attorney General Evel Younger, for the links of La Costa and mafia organized crime to the CIA inside the California prisons. And because of this, he's that person I've mentioned before who was scheduled for surgery at Vacaville to have his mind erased. And through interference at a very critical point and through my calling the warden up at Vacaville, that procedure, surgical or by drugs, was called off and he was sent down to Soledad Prison in California. And there were contracts to kill him. There were threats on persons' lives, a Donnie Trejo, Michael Ankenbrandt, and Mr. Wilson. Three other times he was supposed to be stabbed and killed, and men were told they'd never get out alive if they didn't kill Robert. And he was moved then up to Folsom, and I called the warden up at Folsom. It was just like the perils of Pauline. To keep him alive, he was in solitary confinement constantly and chained down because of his courageous stand to expose these conspiracies. And finally, he did place this lawsuit, and they just sprung him out. They called his wife and said, Robert will be out in 2 weeks. The parole is coming up, and they got him out of the California prisons. And I was so thrilled and excited. We've had a correspondence going on since a year ago, February, where I first learned about his case through a former attorney of Sirhan Sirhan's, Mr. Hansen, Robert Hansen. I learned about Robert Hyde's case. So he's alive and out of prison, and this is one of the more personal satisfactions that I've had, that I could use my research, could use KLRB and this show that is syndicated around the city, and use the news media like the Zodiac News Service and the Earth News, and get the story out each time a crisis appeared and his life was saved. And it is very exciting and thrilling to be able to do these things at a general level and more so at a personal level. And the other person who broke the news, who's breaking the news this week, is a defendant in the trial up in Marin County, the San Quentin 6 trial, which paralleled the trial going in New York, the Attica trial. Hugo Pinnell was fingered in that and charged with killing a guard. He claimed he was innocent. Hugo is the same political mind as George Jackson. He was very fond of George Jackson and similar to Eldridge Cleaver, and he was marked for death or conspiracies against him, such as Jackson had when he was in prison. And Hugo's been in solitary, too, for 4 years at least since that shootout, just 4 years ago this week, August 71, the killing of George Jackson. And Hugo's lived with chains around him, and he's been stabbed and assaulted and maced and persecuted. And he has not trusted lawyers who've sold him down the river on another trial. He originally was just in on a rape charge, and he's been in 10 years now. And Judge Broderick took under consideration whether Hugo Pinnell at this stage could defend himself. It's been 4 years and he's had various lawyers who weren't defending him the way he wanted. And Judge Broderick is a very conservative judge. The defense committee has fought him all the way. They believe he's prejudiced. He's a man who was a friend of Judge Haley, who was killed out of Marin County, and he has emotional bonds to the past. Broderick closed the court last week to decide on the Pinnell decision and came back and said, yes, Hugo Pinnell can defend himself. So this very educated, brilliant theorist, politician, poet is going to be able to say what he wants to say, to ask the questions he wants to without a lawyer, without being kicked out of the courtroom for wanting to express himself and ask the proper questions. I've been corresponding with Hugo since 1972. I've done a tremendous lot of investigative work and tried to help them with Lewis Tackwood from the Los Angeles Police Department, who surfaced and knew that the LAPD had foreknowledge of the shootout and could have prevented it. And through various contacts and a lot of research and some very heartbreaking years, the court case is going very well. We'll do some show on it in a week or two. On the background, again, for those of you who don't remember the shootout 4 years ago. But it was a major victory that Hugo can represent himself. Charles Gary is another one of the attorneys that will be working on the defense. And Hyde is out. The Robert Kennedy case is going. The U story is breaking. And I can say this week, this has been a very good week for Mae Brussel. In terms of the amount of energy I've expended, I feel very good about this. I want to go on to Interpol and talk to you about that, but there's two other matters I just want to bring up first, before we get into that for the remaining half hour of the show. Last week I devoted almost the entire show to various deaths related to the Hughes Corporation or the Watergate that have been taking place in the last few weeks. There were 11 or 12 of them I ran down for you. And I hope those of you who listen take tapes every week or tape cassettes and follow these shows, the continuity. This week there's one more Watergate-related death to add to the list. I mentioned those, Mr. Pennington, who was in McCord's home as soon as McCord was arrested, who died shortly afterwards, and Lou Russell, who worked at McCord Associates, who also worked for with Robert Mayhew from Hughes Corporation. This week there was a small article from the Los Angeles Times. It didn't make the Associated Press, it didn't make the United Press or Reuters, it just said Los Angeles Times Service, a little 3-inch column, former American Nazi Party boss, fatally wounded. It said, El Monte, California, a former leader of the American Nazi Party was shot and killed Friday after he allegedly stalked into the yard of the Nazi Party headquarters here. El Monte police questioned 3 residents of the Nazi headquarters in terms of the shooting. Police identified the slain man as Joseph Tomasi, T-O-M-M-A-S-I, 24, of El Monte. Tomasi was the leader of the American Nazi Party in that city until March of last year, when he formed the El Monte-based group called the National Socialist Liberation Front. Now, Joseph Tomasi may not mean much to you unless you've heard these shows before. Tomasi was the member of the Nazi Party that met at the Beverly Hilton Hotel with Jeb Magruder, with John Mitchell. He worked with G. Gordon Liddy. He was the link to the Watergate, to the American Nazi Party, to the use of the Nazis from Liddy, who was a Nazi lover. Go down the archives and see pictures of Hitler's Gestapo and Nazi for his kicks. The Watergate team, the extreme, then again, these are the links to the Hughes Corporation and E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy. The contacts to Mr. Tomasi were at the Hilton Hotel and in New York City. Joseph Tomasi was a link of the Republican Party, or the clandestine branch of the Republican Party, the Watergate to the Nazis and to terrorism. Mr. Tomasi bragged about the smoke bombing and the smell bombs that went off at the time of the Rosenberg rally in Los Angeles. He's been doing a lot of the terrorism from the right that's been taking place down in Los Angeles. There's a group of Cubans, there's a group of Minutemen, there's a group of Nazis that are doing a lot of this and pretending that they are left-wing radical groups to make the police come down the radicals. And then there's some that take credit just as being pure Nazis and causing terrorism. And I think that the extreme right wing in this country is cleaning up its act, getting its particular witnesses out of the way, whether they're from Lockheed or from the Nazi Party. And so Mr. Tomasi conveniently was killed, and he was linked to a lot of the Watergate that I've talked about before and to violence in Los Angeles. And maybe some of the terrorism in America will stop when the CIA stopped funding these people. And Tomasi was one of those links to the FBI and the CIA, and he is gone now. And so there's the investigation, the secret army organization, or the Watergate continues at any time, they can put all the blame on Tomasi, and he's dead. And that's the way these witnesses move on. Well, I'm going to talk today for the remaining time on Interpol. There isn't much time. I really would need 3 or 4 hours to go Interpol. But 2 weeks ago, we talked about Intertel, I-N-T-E-R-T-E-L. And a good source of information for Intertel was an article that I outlined, Harper's Magazine, December 1974. That's the organization that was formed in 1970 to take over the Hughes empire, to move what allegedly was the body of Hughes, but he's not there. It's made of a retired FBI, CIA, military intelligence with strong links to the Justice Department. And they say retired, but at the time of Watergate, you remember that E. Howard Hunt and James McCord were supposedly retired of the CIA, but they were very much in contact with the CIA at all times for photographs, films, developing disguises, and many, many ways they were constantly related directly to the Central Intelligence Agency. Well, that Hughes empire is controlled by Intertel. They hold the gaming tables of Vegas. They run the state of Nevada. Intertel is one body that was formed in 1970. And that is different than Interpol. Interpol, I-N-T-E-R-P-O-L, stands for International Police. And it's very important to, there is a relationship to Interpol and Intertel and a common denominator. there's a series of articles that you can order from Freedom Magazine. Freedom Magazine. If I'm going too fast, write to me for the address, 5930 Franklin Avenue, Hollywood, California, 90028. They have a long series on Interpol, and I outlined a series of four articles that they have, plus some other articles, and I want to go into it. The question, of course, is how close are we to an international Gestapo? Senator Frank Church said yesterday on national television that the spy government is so massive that Americans would have no way to fight back if a dictator took control. Between Interpol and Intertel, this is the interlocking spy government that is massive and is very tightly coordinated. The connecting links of the U.S. law enforcement to Gestapo, members of the Gestapo from Nazi Germany, is very strong. And the two interlocking agencies, as I say, are Intertel. It was formed in 1970 with government officials Interpol. Now, there are very few books. There's only two or three books on Interpol in your library. There was a good article recently in the newspaper breaking it down. There was an interview with the head of Interpol. And the ties to the Watergate are very close for this reason. Louis Tackwood, again, the police informer who worked 9 years with the Los Angeles Police Department, said that Ed Davis, the chief of police in Los Angeles, had wanted a Gestapo, a police state. And that's the reason Tackwood surfaced after 9 years and left the police department and wrote the Glasshouse tapes. And Ed Davis, the chief of police, works very close with Attorney General Evel Younger, currently a major general in Air Force Reserve. And James McCord worked with these men. He worked with the Los Angeles Police Department. They were forming the Squad 19, planning the riots and violence for the 1972 convention that would take place in San Diego. Now, Ed Davis has applied for a job to become president of Interpol. One of the commissioners from Los Angeles came up to see me to go over the police files of what I call Watergate West, and he didn't know whether Ed Davis should be kicked out of a job in the police department, whether commissioners should consider him or the councilman should consider him as a police chief to be investigated, or what position they should take about Ed Davis. And I talked about Ed Davis and Watergate West, and the remark was made to me, well, maybe instead of investigating Ed Davis, we should just let him have the job he wants as chief of Interpol, chief of Interpol. Well, that's very important if he would want that, because of his links to the Watergate persons, because of the links of the Los Angeles Police Department to the White House and the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, what is Interpol that Mr. Davis may want to become the head of? The current head of Interpol is a Louis Sims, Louis B. Sims. And there's an office in Washington called the United States National Central Bureau, Office of the Treasury. Mr. Sims was formerly a Secret Service agent. He joined the Secret Service in 1961. His job now as chief is an assignment. He claims that he did not request the job of Interpol to be the head of it. He didn't request it. He was assigned it in September of 74. He did Secret Service work in Chicago in the Technical Security Division before this assignment. In Chicago, much of the riots are being opened up now, and the violence done by the Watergate team, the allegations of E. Howard Hunt being there and Bernard Barker, I understand there's some indictments coming in there. And Charlie Bates, who was in charge of the SLA FBI investigation and conspiracy out in California, came from Chicago also. There is a nest of espionage in Chicago that runs through these various conspiracies. The Office of Interpol has a staff of 9 people. 3 of them are federal agents and investigators. The rest are administrators, and they come from Customs, Drug Enforcement Agency, Federal Law Enforcement Agencies, and Office of the Secretary of the Treasury. Now, Interpol is supposed to be a conduit between law enforcement agencies in this country and abroad. It's supposed to be involved with criminal investigations, international police. But the background of Interpol is that it was formed by members of the Gestapo. It was formed in Germany. I'll give you some of this background. In 1923, and Hitler took hold of it through the 30s and 40s, and members of the Gestapo kept lists of so-called enemies, which they buried and then brought back to Paris. And at the time that the Gestapo chief was the head of, J. Edgar Hoover was brought over there to be vice president, to work with the Gestapo over there, and it explains why none of the Nazis were sought out after World War II, because the organization of Interpol under Section 3 says that they will not seek any international Nazis. It was up to private citizens like Simon Wiesenthal, Wiesenthal in Germany, to look for ex-Nazis. Interpol, international police, did not consider Nazis as war criminals, and the condition of Interpol was that they'd never go after them, and this is why the Nazis are not sought. They're not criminals in their minds. Interpol reaches 120 countries. They belong to it, and their world headquarters, the world headquarters, consists of an executive committee, and there's 13 individuals. Paul Knight of our Secret Service was elected to the executive committee, and the Secretary General answers to the General Assembly. There's a voluntary contribution by our Treasury Department of $135,000, but then there's unlisted money from AID and State Department and Narcotics Division. Now, Interpol is being investigated at the present time by Congressman Montoya. He says that the documented history of Interpol raises many serious allegations concerning the organization, its history of international intelligence network, and its access to data on millions of U.S. citizens. Whether you know it or not, any file or anything about you can be sent automatically to the headquarters in Paris, and they keep a record, and you cannot get your record of what they send over, and from then on, it belongs to them. The FBI is linked directly to Interpol and can send anything over there they want. The FBI National Computer Information Center feeds Interpol its information for the international police. Interpol is much larger in scope than any CIA or FBI activities. As I say, there's only three books about it. It's been in existence 51 years. Interpol is a secret conductor for the intelligence arms of various countries, wherever they're formed, access to all FBI files and federal government files. There's a constant, unregulated leak of information that goes out to any country who wants it, at any police agencies, about any citizen in America. Information on U.S. citizens is turned over to political intelligence arms of every other country. Now, I talked before, and I have to go into it at length again, about the data bank on private citizens in the United States kept by the Mormons in Salt Lake City, Utah, outside of Salt Lake, in these caves. But Interpol is an international data bank. Interpol is not a law enforcement agency of any kind. It is an international intelligence network. It is a network, and information on every U.S. citizen or citizens from many other countries is being fed into this organization in Paris. It is called a private organization, yet it has access to all of our government files, and it has a greater resource capability than the CIA is admitting. The FBI files contain millions of records of Americans, and it's been turned over to Senator Montoya and other members of Congress that the files are not screened, and the FBI is turning this over to Paris to Interpol. The money, as I say, comes from the Treasury Department. What are the Watergate connections to Interpol? I'll go into that, and then I'll go into the historical background of the Nazis in Interpol. Interpol is staffed, as I say, from the Treasury Department since 1958. It's kept a very low profile. You haven't heard of it till today, or maybe just recently. It's protected from public scrutiny. The covert operations of its own keep going on in Washington, can hide what they're doing. It's very secretive. In 1942, the first officials of Interpol met, this was in 1942, in Germany, the officials met for the final solution of Gypsies and Jews. It was that organization, through Reinhard Heydrich and Ernest Kaltenbrunner, head of the Gestapo, who also became presidents of Interpol. In 1942, they decided on the final solution, and it's interesting that their files are still active, that they were hit, they were put away, and they were hidden, and then brought back and reactivated, and they have these files on the of Jews around the world in the Interpol files right now. In 1957, Miles Ambrose approached J. Edgar Hoover, who was a vice president of Interpol, and asked the FBI director if the U.S. Treasury could join Interpol, and Hoover and Ambrose had several meetings. Ambrose coordinated the Secret Service and intelligence operations at one time of the IRS, and he led the official U.S. delegation to Interpol. He left the Treasury Department in 1960, then went to work for the Bureau of Customs in 69. His name came out, Mr. Ambrose, with various scandals regarding the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Nixon Watergate stories. He was one of the delegates from U.S. to join Interpol. In 1969, Eugene Rosides from the Treasury Department, you may have heard his name at the time of the Watergate, R-O-S-S-I-D-E-S, from the Treasury, took over the enforcement and operations sections of the Treasury, and then he started joining Interpol in Europe in 1969, Mr. Rosides. Now, Gerald Ford contacted Mr. Rosides and said, I have a man who is interested in a job, he needs a job, and his name is G. Gordon Liddy, Gerald Ford. In 1969, the representative from Michigan called Mr. Rosides, who is attached to Interpol, representing as a delegate, and said, the man from upstate New York needs a job, his name is G. Gordon Liddy. Well, when we go into the Nazi background, you can appreciate that, because as I say, G. Gordon Liddy is tremendously sympathetic to Hitler and Nazi Germany. And he asked Rosides to help out. Rosides helped out, and Liddy, a former FBI and CIA agent, was posted as a Treasury Special Assistant and given an office a few doors down from the hall from Interpol. Now, G. Gordon Liddy was out in California at Davis's territory at the Dr. Lewis Fielding offices. G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt worked with Ed Davis on the Squad 19 plans for San Diego, and Liddy was down the hall from Interpol working with Rosides. Ambrose in the Drug Department moved into the Justice Department and headed Nixon's new drug enforcement agency, the DEA, at the same time that he was on Interpol. Ambrose and Rosides quietly served Interpol together, and 6 months after Watergate, Rosides resigned from Interpol because of the scandal of Watergate and decided to go into private practice. But the Treasury Department keeps strong ties with the international police even after Ambrose and Rosides left, but they weren't bashful about G. Gordon Liddy becoming affiliated with Interpol, and it was Gerald Ford who made the original contact. Now, the background of this organization, it's part of an army of Nazi Gestapo. They had lists of criminals, the Nazis called criminals, the SS troops, and those documents were supposed to be destroyed. In 1923, Interpol got started out of Vienna. It was after the end of World War I when Germany was secretly rearming. Interpol got started in Vienna, continued operating from 38 to 39. The United States joined Interpol in 38. And then the war period came in 1950. The United States, the Justice Department, the FBI, handled the American participation and pulled away and began to take an interest in them later. In 1945 to 46, when Hitler lost the war, a Interpol was formed again. We weren't connected with them during the years that the war was going on, but in 46, an Oscar Dressler, the Secretary General of Interpol, signed an affidavit that he had taken all the Interpol funds from Vienna to Berlin, and the documents showed that their original lists were very much alive. A man from 46 to 56, F.E. Louage, was president of Interpol, and they first denied that the records from the Nazis existed. They said they were destroyed. They promised Congress they were destroyed. Now it turns out that they formed Interpol again with the Gestapo men, the SS men, and that these records were not destroyed. They're very much alive, and they're in Paris at the present time. These files were used by Hitler and by the police departments in every city that Hitler took over to blackmail politicians and recruit members for the Gestapo, for the special services, the Gestapo. Simon Wiesenthal, as I say, the famous Nazi hunter, reported that this blackmailing and recruiting was done, and yet the agents that were guilty are allowed to live, and they've not been prosecuted or found except by private individuals. In 1943 to 46, Ernest Kaltenbrunner, head of the Nazi SS Gestapo, surfaced. He was the president of Interpol through that period, and he worked with Heydrich. He was hung. Heydrich was hung as a war criminal in Nuremberg. And Kaldenbrunner headed the German police when he was the president of Interpol. He was the head of Hitler's police department while he headed Interpol. They were one and the same. The police department and the Gestapo were the same. And Mr. Heydrich, after 1942, headed Interpol. He was later assassinated as a war criminal. He was the one who, at the Interpol meetings, had the data banks and the information and managed to cremate at least 6 million people as a final solution. Heydrich and Kaltenbrunner were both war criminals, but their records lived on. And another Nazi officer became president of Interpol from 1968 to 1972. His name is Paul Dickoff, D-I-C-K-O-P-F. He was SS officer 337259, president of Interpol until 1972. He claimed that he was forced to join the Hitler army, his sympathies weren't there, but he actually in 45 fled Germany and went to Switzerland, and this is where the top Nazis were meeting with Alan Dulles over in Switzerland, and he became president of Interpol until 1972. Interpol's purpose, their overt purpose, was to be non-political, but their extermination of Jews and their overt purpose was very well concealed while they kept their list going, and they still have them today. J. Edgar Hoover was secretly elected vice president of Interpol in 1946. While the members of the Gestapo were the president of Interpol, J. Edgar Hoover went over to Europe to become the vice president of Interpol in 1946. This was despite orders from the United States State Department that they should not participate. In 1946, Dean Acheson and the State Department said, don't get involved with Interpol. But Hoover and his FBI began to cooperate immediately and give the Interpol data information on private citizens in the United States to the International Police in Paris. And J. Edgar Hoover became the vice president over there in 1946 and was active with the Gestapo members all of this time. As I say, Hitler used Interpol from 38 to 45. He kept files and networks of citizens, and as each city was taken and the commando groups were instructed to gather the police files, they centralized them into one organization. The December 8th meeting, 1941, was the Jewish problem, and Reinhard Heydrich, as I say, the head of the Gestapo, became president of Interpol, and at that meeting, they decided that they would do the final solution of the Jews and the Gypsies, and the order went out. And those that they didn't kill, those names are still on lists, and they are available, and the United States Treasury Department still funds Interpol, and this is where Senator Montoya is investigating it at this time. Interpol's Secretary General, since 1924, was a member of the Gestapo. Their overture, as I say, was non-political. What they were supposed to be doing was to be fighting. This was their outward cover, war on drugs, war on prostitution, and counterfeiting. Does that sound familiar? Mr. Ed Davis in Los Angeles is crying about the women's movement, about prostitution in Los Angeles. We recently heard that there was counterfeiting of the CIA in Vietnam, $22 billion, a scandal. It was on the headlines one day and left the next day. And I wonder if the only reason that story broke of counterfeiting was an excuse for more international police. This is what Hitler used: war on drugs, war on prostitution, and war on counterfeiting. And they set up international police for those three excuses. And look at the parallels today on the war on drugs, prostitution, counterfeiting, those excuses that were non-political. And actually what they were doing was compiling names from police departments for Jewish extermination and extermination of gypsies, and 30 years later coming down on the hippies, the nomads of America, American youth, creating the Manson case. We'll go into that some more in a few weeks. In the same language Interpol used years ago, they're using it in 1960s and 70s, and two former Nazis are saying now that Interpol is not political. And yet, in Germany, while they were saying it was not political, that they were helping the country on these various things, their ovens were burning at Dachau, at Buchenwald, Treblinka, and they were deciding that the criminals were Jews and Gypsies. Now, the rebirth of Interpol after World War II, when the Third Reich was collapsing, began over in Switzerland, where these Nazis were meeting with Alan Dulles. The European police felt that Nazism was the wave of the future, so they kept their files and they kept their lists. In 1946, a political Belgian police agent, Florent Louage, L-O-U-W-A-G-E, and a Swedish gentleman named Harry Soderman gathered what was left of Interpol, and they put the organization back together again when Hitler lost the war, and they moved the papers to Belgium and then to Paris, so that May 15th, 1946, the U.S. was invited to attend this conference. As I say, Dean Acheson was cautious about it, and the FBI was cautious, and J. Edgar Hoover just went ahead and joined, and he entered into Interpol and became the vice president in 1946. And he was mysteriously elected the vice president at this conference, and he remained the vice president until 1950 with members of the Gestapo meeting over there in Germany and maintaining lists of what they call criminals. Now, we know the list of criminals that J. Edgar Hoover had in the last few years, the rock star musicians, the Black Panthers, the women's movement, the Socialist Workers' Party. So you can imagine being the vice president of Interpol from 46 to 50 with the old Nazi records and the new FBI databanks, just what Interpol is about. J. Edgar Hoover had been affiliated with that organization since 35 when Hitler was rearming. He joined them again as vice president, and he worked with Nazi collaborators who did work out the final solution at the conferences back in Germany. Support it now. Interpol was supposed to come out untainted with regards to the Nazi documents that they said they destroyed them. And Mr. Louage turned out was a collaborator. He was a Nazi. He said he wasn't. As late as June 1944, he was working with the Nazi government as a collaborator. He was listed in the International Criminal Polizei and Nazi Interpol as being on the staff. He was a frequent his name is in these new documents that have been discovered of being linked to the Nazis. And as I say, Mr. Dickhoff, in 1968, elected president of Interpol. He was SS number 337259. He took the position from SS Reinhard Heydrich. These gentlemen were very much part of the German Gestapo. In 1974, Interpol has a list of criminals. We don't know what it is. It comes from the police departments, as I say, of 120 countries. It comes from our FBI that feeds them information from our Treasury Department. And it is still combining forces with the same cover story of getting drug people charged on drugs and various minor crimes, while the computer and data bank at home in Utah and in Paris continues to be compiled. Well, you could write to Senator Montoya, Democrat of New Mexico, ask him to open this up. That's a subcommittee on Treasury Appropriations. You can ask for him for information on Interpol. You can write to Freedom Magazine, 5930 Franklin Avenue, Hollywood, California, 90002. We'll do maybe a little more next week on the links of Intertel to Interpol. But Interpol is very active. It started after breaking the Versailles Treaty when Germany was rearming. It carried the worst war criminals. Two of them were hung, and other Nazis took over. America joined them. America supports them. And they receive information about us, private citizens, with no control of what goes over there. So if you don't like that, write to Senator Montoya and ask him to open it up. Congress is looking into the links. And write to Secretary of Treasury William Simon if you think he'll do any good. And let's find out the real story of Interpol, international police. And let's open up the Robert Kennedy assassination and find out if Ed Davis was a big part in concealing that conspiracy there and remove him from the police departments anywhere before he becomes the president of Interpol for us and represents us and the international police. 1 minute over, but I started 1 minute late. I'll see you next week. Dialogue Conspiracy. Take care of yourselves.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist May Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California.